Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Anne Blaney makes a first appearance at the Sydney Institute on the occasion of the publication of her book, The Turbulent Life of Charles Kingsford Smith, King of the Air, which has recently come out. Now, Anne Blaney's name is well known to all of us, but I guess I'll introduce her briefly as the author of several acclaimed biographies, including I Am Melba on Dame Nellie Melba, which won the 2009 National Biography Award. And the topic of tonight's talk is King of the Air, The Turbulent Life of Charles Kingsford Smith. Anne Blaney, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, thank you. Can everyone hear? Please, if you can't hear, tell me, and we can try and do something about it. Thank you, Gerard, very much. A lovely introduction. Actually, I have spoken here before. I spoke about Melba in May 2012. Yes, in a different building, not in this one. Yes, absolutely. Well, it's very nice to be back. Thank you very much. People often ask me why I did write about Kingsford Smith and why also I wrote about Melba. And the two names are sort of combined in this answer. When I turned 65, and I'm a lot older than 65, I will admit, Geoffrey, my husband down there, Geoffrey Blaney, said to me, "Now you're so old, I think that you should be writing about only very famous people. You've written four or five biographies about people who are interesting, but they were only moderately famous. Now you must do really famous people, and you must try to do Australians, and then you can get the material here, and we don't have to go overseas for ages, and I have to wait around while you do your research." So I took that on board. I thought it was good advice about the famous people at any rate. And so I looked down the list, and I saw Nellie Melba, and I'd already studied singing for some years in my youth, and I knew a bit about music, so I thought this is a comfortable area to move into, and she's an inspiring woman, this will be good. And it was. It took me 6 years, but it was good. And then I looked down again, and the next most famous was Charles Kingsford Smith, internationally known in Australia. And I looked at him, and I thought, I'm not into planes, and I'm not into engines and boys, things like that. And I wonder how I will get on. And then I looked again and I saw that he had what I call a theatrical edge, an artistic edge to him. He was an excellent musician. He'd been a choir pupil at St Andrew's Cathedral. In fact, I'm speaking there on Thursday night because he's their most famous old boy. And he was good at acting, amateur acting. The whole family were. His eldest brother actually hoped to be a Shakespearean actor. I might say he ended up managing a bank up in Atherton in North Queensland. It was a bit far from being a Shakespearean actor, but he did take lessons, and it was his older brother who got the name of Kingsford before Smith because he said it would be a disgrace to be a great actor and simply be called Smith. So Kingsford was his mother's maiden name, so they all took up the Kingsford. So that was the explanation for that. But there were certain things between the two people that I did find were the same. It's something about, I think, that period in the 20s and 30s, 1920s and 30s in Australia, it happens to very famous people. It's the tall poppy syndrome. Both of those people were accused, publicly accused, and it often appeared in the newspapers, of being alcoholics. Melba certainly wasn't an alcoholic. She could never have had that career if she had been. And Kingsford Smith, I can find no evidence whatsoever in the 1930s that he was an alcoholic. He did drink heavily during the First World War in the Royal Flying Corps, but that they all did. It was the only way they could survive. The average expectation of life in 1917 was 2 or 3 weeks. Then they were dead. So they drank to have courage, and you can understand it. But in the 1930s, Kingsford Smith was a sober character, and I cannot understand. I believe it's even in Wikipedia. Wikipedia that he had drinking problems in the 1930s, and I do want to refute that. Melba was much better at managing fame than Kingsford Smith was, and much better at managing her life if it came to that. But there were a lot of resemblances, and that way of what they did with fame was something that began to fascinate me when I got into both their lives. And having said all that, I'll start the proper part of the talk. Nellie Melba, the great opera singer, is said to be the most internationally famous of all Australians. But also famous internationally, in much the same period, was Charles Kingsford Smith, the great Australian aviator. At the time of his famous flights, which were in the 1920s and 30s, aviators were the rock stars of the age. And foremost among these glamorous creatures was Kingsford Smith. In America, his fellow aviators voted him the greatest flyer of his generation, and they gave him a special title in America. They called him the daddy of us all. Smithy, as he was popularly called by his fans, was born in Hamilton, a riverside suburb of Brisbane. His father's name in those days was plain William Smith. It would be another 5 or 6 years before the family added Kingsford to its name, and I've already explained to you about how they came to be Kingsford. In the years prior to Smithy's birth, William Smith had been the manager of the Cairns branch of the Bank of North Queensland. However, a bad attack of malaria impaired William's health, and in 1896, the bank invalided him to the cooler climates of Brisbane and Sydney. Thus it was that William's seventh and last child, Charles, the great aviator, was born in Brisbane on the 9th of February 1897 and spent the first years of his life in Brisbane and then in Sydney. In 1899, while he was managing the Sydney office of the Bank of North Queensland, the ailing William resigned from the bank and 4 years later sailed with his family to a new city of opportunity, to Vancouver in Western Canada. Now, there was a bad recession in Australia at that period, early 1900s, very bad droughts and great loss of sheep. Flocks of sheep were decimated. And so a lot of people were thinking of emigrating, and Canada was needing immigrants, particularly that west coast, and so William decided that he would be among them and he would take his family with him. There, William quickly found work as a voucher clerk for the Canadian Pacific Railway. He got on so well that a couple of years later, he left off clerking and went to business for himself, opening a store that imported, among other things, goods from Australia. His business flourished until 1908, when a bad harvest tilted the Canadian economy into recession. Anxious to cut his losses, William and his family sailed back to Sydney. By this time, Smithy was 12 years old, an intelligent, hyperactive lad, full of fun and pranks, and something of a daredevil. He was also fascinated by engines, and he was skilled at playing the piano. Seeking a suitable school for him in Sydney, his parents discovered that, thanks to his musical talent, St. Andrew's Cathedral School was prepared to accept him as a chorister and a pupil. He did well at school, receiving an excellent general education and learning the value of serious study. He remained at the Cathedral School until his voice broke. He was almost 15 by that time. Then he transferred to the Sydney Technical High School to study electrical engineering. And at 16, he took up an apprenticeship at the Colonial Sugar Refinery. And there he might have stayed had not war broken out. Smithy enlisted in the AIF as soon as he turned 18, and because of his engineering training and his skills at riding a motorbike, he was made a dispatch rider in the 4th Signal Company of the Australian Light Horse. In June 1915, he and his fellow signalers sailed for Egypt, and after a few months' training were sent to Gallipoli. They were extraordinarily lucky. By October 1915, the bitter fighting was over and life on the Gallipoli Peninsula had become almost humdrum. A few months later, he and his fellow signalers took part in the remarkable evacuation, an exercise carried out so stealthily that the Turks were unaware that anything was happening until almost every man was safely away. Back in Egypt, Smithy was shipped to France to serve as a motorcycle dispatch rider in Flanders and on the Somme. Life was unspeakably grim, and he was thankful in September 1916 to answer a call for volunteers for the Royal Flying Corps. And from that moment, as he often said, his real life began. After a short training course, he entered the RFC as a second lieutenant and was appointed to a squadron at La Levee near the French-Belgian border. The death rate was fearsome. The average survival time for a pilot was 2 or 3 weeks. This is early 1917. But Smithy was not only survived, he prospered. It was clear from the start that he had a natural gift for flying, and he threw himself into it, heart and soul. On 14th of August 1917, during an aerial dogfight, part of his left foot was shot off by a German bullet. He spent the next 4 months in London in a hospital, and in recognition of his bravery, he received the Military Cross from George V at Buckingham Palace. And here I will tell you a little story that Smithy used to tell. I think it's basically true. He might have embellished it slightly. He went to Buckingham Palace on crutches with a cast on his foot, which hadn't healed, and he had been told that when the king finished pinning the medal on his breast and shaking his hand and so on, he must walk backwards out of the presence a few feet before he turned around to go out the door. Well, George V was said to be a very stern man and wasn't very unbending, but he must have taken pity on Smithy. Smithy was very small. He was only about my height. People think he was very tall, but in fact, this was very useful, actually, in planes, because if you had long legs, you had trouble with them in the cockpit. His co-pilot, Charles Om, who was 6 feet, used to get cramp in his legs, but Smithy didn't. Smithy found this very convenient, although he was a bit ashamed. He thought it was a bit unmasculine to be so short. But anyway, the king saw him standing there, and as he pinned it on, he said to him, "My boy, your mother will be very proud of you today." And Smithy responded correctly and bowed and then started to move back. And, of course, the crutches went from under his arms, and he fell all in a heap of the king's feet. Well, the king rushed and picked him up, pushed away the equerries who tried to help, put the sticks under his arms, and he said, "My boy, don't worry about moving back. Just go out any way you can and tell your grandchildren that you had permission to turn your back on the king." It's a nice story. I hope it is true. I think basically it probably is. Returning to civilian life, he found it hard to fit in, and he was often depressed. For one thing, all he wanted to do was fly, and flying as a profession was still in its infancy. He spent over a year in California stunt flying for an aerial circus and giving joy rides to paying passengers, an occupation that was then called barnstorming. Still is, I think, called barnstorming. But stunting and barnstorming, and he liked barnstorming, were not enough. What he really wanted was to perform a daring aeronautical feat, like flying across the Pacific Ocean. Now, the reason I think he picked the Pacific Ocean was because while he was in California, he was actually staying with his oldest brother. The one who wanted to be an actor and ended up as a bank manager had migrated to California and was doing very well there. There was an advertisement in local papers that a movie mogul by the name of Thomas Ince, I-N-C-E, was giving a huge prize for the first person to cross by air across the Pacific. And Smithy longed to do it. But, of course, he had no backer, he had no plane, he had no organisation to help him. So it was out of his compass altogether. Eventually, the prize was withdrawn because no one had actually put their hand up for it. But this stayed always in Smithy's mind, and it went on to become quite obsessive as the years passed. Was the thing he really wanted to do, cross the Pacific Ocean. Back in Australia, Smithy tried to pull himself together. He became senior pilot in the newly formed West Australian Airways, which flew regular flights from Geraldton to Derby. Now, this is a very interesting airways. At this time, 1921, it's the longest scheduled air service in the world. The only service that comes anywhere near it is Lyon in France to Casablanca in Morocco, and that was not nearly as far nor nearly as difficult. And here was little Western Australian Airways with a couple of Bristol tourers, which had been war surplus. Well, most of the planes then in Australia were war surplus from England, running this very important regular route up the coast of Western Australia. And they've got another first too, because while Smithy was employed by them, in February 1922, he looks to me to be the first pilot in Australia to fly a doctor to a patient or a patient to a doctor. This was quite a regular thing they did. And so, of course, this is a precursor to the famous flying doctor service, and one never hears this given to the credit of Western Australian Airways. Connecting the isolated ports along the West Australian coast was important work, but it failed to satisfy his daredevil spirit, and soon he exchanged the monotony of flying regular air routes for running a transport service to the outlying stations in the Pilbara, carrying wool clips by truck to ports for shipping to far-off markets. He also found a wife, a nice country girl named Thelma Corboy, who came from a cattle station not far from Marble Bar. Smithy, however, was not cut out for marriage any more than he was cut out for flying to a schedule or running a trucking business. In 1925, he left his wife and the trucking business, and in company with a fellow pilot named Keith Anderson, he relocated to Sydney. Here, he and Anderson started up a charter air service. They said, with given proper notice, they would fly you to anywhere in the world. Most of the flights were very, very close to Sydney, but this was on their advertisement. And I don't know what would have happened if somebody had asked to be taken off somewhere anywhere in the world. I think they'd have had considerable trouble, but that was what they put very bravely. Here they started up a charter air service, and here Smithy had the momentous meeting of his life. He met Charles Ulm. Charles Ulm, Smithy later wrote, was my twin spirit. Charles Ulm had similar ideas to mine. He wanted to do something that would make the world sit up. And in due course, that was just what the two of them did. Ulm was a born organiser and Smithy was a born pilot, and both were inspired by Charles Lindbergh's aerial crossing of the Atlantic Ocean, a feat that had hitherto been considered impossible because of the difficulties of refuelling over a vast expanse of sea. Planes, they now discovered, could be procured with sufficient tanks to allow them to travel vast distances without refuelling. Armed with this knowledge, they began seriously to plan the Pacific crossing. They also began to badger the state and federal governments to finance their scheme. They got nowhere with the federal government, but once they had demonstrated their prowess by making a record flight around Australia, only the second flight around Australia, the New South Wales Premier, Jack Lang, began to listen to them. He agreed to back the Pacific flight, and they and Keith Anderson sailed off for California. They arrived in California in August 1927. There followed almost a year of effort and disappointment, during which Anderson gave up and returned to Sydney, driven out in part, I'm afraid to say, by Ulm, who did not want to share the success of their enterprise with anybody but Smithy. Meanwhile, Ulm and Smithy struggled on, back in California. The month of March of 1928 saw their lowest ebb. The New South Wales government withdrew its guarantee, and their plane, a Fokker trimotor, which they had named the Southern Cross, was about to be repossessed for debt. But just when everything seemed to have touched rock bottom, they were introduced to a sympathetic American millionaire named Alan Hancock. He took a great liking to these two young Australians, and he agreed to finance the flight. Moreover, he presented them with a competent American crew, an experienced navigator named Harry Lyon, later the United States Navy, and an experienced wireless operator named Jim Warner, formerly of the United States Navy also. It's doubtful if they would have succeeded without Lyon and Warner. They were older, they were experienced, and they knew what they were doing. On the 31st of May 1928, the four of them took off from California's Oakland Aerodrome. Their first stop was to be Hawaii, their second was to be Fiji, and from Fiji they planned to fly onto Eagle Farm in Brisbane. At first, their flight was not so difficult. Planes had already flown from California to Hawaii, and a wireless beacon in Honolulu kept their navigator on course. But the second and third sections, Hawaii to Fiji and Fiji to Brisbane, were uncharted territory, and they had no idea what they were flying into. No one so far had any knowledge of the tropical convergence zone, that area near Fiji where trade winds clash and erupt into violent storms. The aviators met such terrible turbulence that they were almost blown out of the sky. Conditions on board the aircraft were also difficult to bear. The plane was drafty and cramped. The noise of the engines was so deafening that ordinary conversation was impossible, and communication was carried on through written notes, some of which you can still read today in the National Library in Canberra. Since a large petrol tank blocked the door between the cockpit and the cabin, Smithy and Ulm devised the idea of attaching a written message to a long stick which they poked through a small hole at the side of the door until it reached the cabin crew. The answer was then poked back into the cockpit in a similar way, and it usually went into the stick with the message on it collided with the back of Smithy's neck. Worst of all, the pilots and crew sat on wicker chairs, chosen because of their lack of weight. And when a storm hit, the flyers bounced about the ceiling. I mean, it must have been quite incredible up there. They had terrible storms. Nobody thought it necessary to bolt the chairs to the floor, and nobody thought it was necessary to provide seat belts. So they just flew. They just flew around in the cockpit too. Nevertheless, thanks to skill, courage, and good organisation, they survived. And when on the 9th of June they finally reached Australia, vast excited crowds were waiting for them. Australians had been following their progress through the newspapers, and most especially by means of that new invention, the radio. Morse code communications sent from the plane to the Amalgamated Wireless headquarters, I think it's at La Perouse near Sydney, or in Sydney, I suppose, then, during the flight, had been translated into ordinary words and were read out over radio stations in Sydney and Melbourne. It was not unusual for groups of fans to sit up through the night, partying and listening in. Now, most of us here probably are old enough to remember when the cricket scores used to come in all through the night and people used to have parties, didn't they? Big parties of listening in. Yeah, that was the beginning of it. It changed our social history quite across the Pacific. This shared experience gave ordinary Australians an unusually close affinity with Smithy and Ulm. Not only had these two aviators become national heroes, they felt like close friends. Smithy's informality of manner and his cheeky sense of fun, he was very cheeky, reinforced these feelings, although it should be said that he could be formal and serious if the situation required. His biggest following, however, was among young women. He had a sexual magnetism that few women could resist. His love affairs are said to be numerous, and women comprised a large proportion of his fans. We're sure of this because the newspapers were always telling you how many women were present when he was barnstorming or when he was giving a speech. There was an inquiry where he was more or less on trial, and they said the witness box was bright with the bright colours of women's dresses. They weren't using a jury, so the ordinary people sat in the jury box, and it was full of females in bright dresses. Also, we know about this because in the National Library in Canberra, there's a file, and it's all from women, women that he didn't know who were offering him, well, some respectable things like marriage, but a lot of unrespectable things as well. And they didn't mind putting it on paper. And some of these I think he probably accepted by the sound of things. In the 7 years following that first Pacific flight, Smithy performed more memorable aeronautical feats. He became the first pilot to fly across the Tasman Sea to New Zealand, and in 1930 he became the first pilot to fly across the Atlantic Ocean from east to west, which, because of headwinds, was a more difficult journey than from west to east. Lindbergh, of course, did it from America to Europe, and he did it from Europe to America, Smithy. Mm. By completing this Atlantic crossing, he achieved his ambition of being the first aviator to fly right around the world by crossing the equator. The globe of the world is like an egg, isn't it? And you can go around this little top bit, which is what you break off when you're eating a boiled egg. That was easy to go around. But it's very hard to go right around the fat part. Circumnavigate the fat part. This is why he's called the Aerial Magellan. He's the first person in the world to ever do that. And that gave him a great deal of kudos. The Americans were so excited by his transatlantic flight that when he arrived in New York, they gave him and his crew a ticker tape parade down Broadway. Only Australian to get it. And some lives of Smithy, I'm sorry to say it never happened, but they're absolutely wrong. For one thing, there's newsreels that actually show it. And seeing is believing. He certainly got his ticker tape parade. That same year of 1930, he also joined Charles Ulm as a co-founder of the successful passenger and freight company Australian National Airways, a company that we remember now as ANA. Smithy was never a businessman. He said that quite honestly. He left that part of the operation to Ulm. But for a time, he did his share of piloting the company's planes between Brisbane, Sydney, Melbourne and Hobart. But not all was triumph. There were also tragedies. Early in 1929, less than a year after the Pacific crossing, he, Ulm and a crew of two set out on their first flight to England. A few hours into the flight, they were forced down on a muddy river flat near the coast of northwest Australia, an area that they later facetiously nicknamed Coffee Royal. They were to remain there, unrescued and close to starving, for 13 days. Search parties were dispatched to find them, and on one of these, Smithy's friend, Keith Anderson, lost his life. Now, I'm wondering if any of you heard a news item the other morning on... You did. Someone is retracing Keith Anderson's flight and what happened to him. He went down in the Tanami Desert. He had a mechanic with him who was able to fix the plane, but they couldn't take off because they didn't have an axe and they couldn't chop any a runway through the scrub. And so they died from lack of food and water. Very, very sad thing to happen. A very stupid thing of Anderson's, I'm afraid, because he had fallen out with Smithy and Ulm. And when they got back to Australia, he actually instituted a court case because he thought he should have had some of the reward for crossing the Pacific. There were a lot of people gave money to Smithy and Ulm, and also the government gave money to Smithy and Ulm, and he thought he should have had a share in it. The judge ruled otherwise, but Smithy, who was basically a very kind man, said to Anderson that he would lend him the money to buy a plane, and he wanted all this to be forgotten, and Anderson wanted it all to be forgotten too. So when Smithy got lost, Anderson wanted to show that, as far as he was concerned, Smithy was still his best mate, and he got in the plane with this other man called what? God, it's got out of my mind. I just told you too. Anyway, got in the plane and off he went, and. Didn't take a proper compass. His compass was faulty. Didn't take food and water. Didn't take an axe. Just went. Completely emotional decision. And that was what happened to him. And it was all a great sadness. And it haunted Smithy for the rest of his life. So great was the furor over Smithy and Ulm's disappearance and Anderson's death that once the aviators were found, a government inquiry was set up to investigate the circumstances of their forced landing. And when it was revealed that Ulm had boasted in the past that the best way to obtain money and publicity was to pretend to be lost, many suspected that Smithy and Ulm had perpetrated a publicity hoax, a hoax, moreover, that had led to the tragic death of Anderson. It was a false accusation, but it was pursued by influential newspapers, and it haunted Smithy and Ulm for the rest of their lives. Ulm was terribly stupid. This was a sort of childish, almost adolescent boasting he used to do in pubs, that he knew all about how to manage publicity, and he used to say that this, and then it came back in this instance to bite him. To make matters worse, the official inquiry took place at a time when Smithy and Ulm were acutely worried by the loss of one of their ANA planes. The plane, which was called the Southern Cloud, disappeared during a flight between Sydney and Melbourne, and they could only guess at its fate because it carried no radio. Smithy and a band of fellow pilots searched for weeks to no avail. The loss of public confidence that inevitably ensued signalled the end of ANA, for the airline was already suffering from the worldwide economic depression, and it could not survive this further blow. It's not found till 1958, this plane. It's found up in Kyandra by a snowy mountain worker, and it had been there all that time. But it was so well off course that nobody thought to look there. At the time of the disappearance of the Southern Cloud, Smithy was a newly married man. He'd met his second wife on a ship sailing from North America to Australia. Her name was Mary Powell. She was 18 years old, and to celebrate the end of her school days, she was being taken around the world by her wealthy parents. Mary came from a well-known racing family in Melbourne. Her uncle, Gus Powell, was a respected owner and trainer of racehorses, and Gus's champion hurdler, Moss Trooper, was one of the great winners in the history of the Australian turf. Mary's father, Arthur Powell, was also in the horse business, selling horses known as whalers to the British Army in India. Indeed, Smithy's later flights owed much to racing and to horses, for they were partly financed by his racing in-laws. In December 1930, Mary Powell and Smithy were married at Scott's Church in Melbourne. But the wedding grew out of hand when the church was invaded by avid fans who, hoping for a better view, climbed onto the back of the pews. It was Mary's first taste of the public glare under which she would spend her brief married life. 2 years later, their only child was born, a boy named Charles Arthur, who lives now in the United States, and who I'm happy to say has read my book with approval and pleasure. In the early 1930s, the stress under which Smithy was living began to affect his health. When hoping to break a time record, he flew back solo from England in October 1930. He almost passed out from faintness and nausea and was consumed by what he described as a sense of dread. Today, these symptoms would be diagnosed as a panic attack, but in 1930, little was known about psychological illness. Smithy saw nothing shameful in his symptoms, and he wrote and spoke frankly about them. Perhaps he shouldn't have, because rumours began to spread that he was a coward and an alcoholic, and that his nausea and faintness sprang from a craving for alcohol that he dared not satisfy in the air. In other words, they accused him of having alcoholic withdrawal symptoms. The rumours were untrue, but unfortunately they persist to this day, and they have, I'm ashamed to say, been fanned by some of his biographers. The rumours hurt him deeply. He fought back, refusing to abandon his flights. Hoping to lessen the force of the attacks, he kept a healthy diet, slept 8 hours a night, and took regular exercise at the gym. When, regardless of his care, panic still struck him while he was flying, he simply toughed it out. In this condition, between 1931 and 33, he broke 3 time records between Australia and England. I don't think he could have done that if he'd been an alcoholic. In these years, he also became involved in a famous air race. In 1934, the confectioner millionaire McPherson Robertson, milk kisses, remember, and all those things from our youth, that was McPherson Robertson, offered a prize of £10,000 for the winner of an air race between England and Melbourne. A galaxy of international aviators competed, and Smithy might well have won had he not insisted on flying an American plane. He considered American machines were faster and better adapted to the needs of the race than British ones, and he sailed to California to buy a Lockheed Altair, then one of the fastest planes in the world. His decision was highly disapproved of by British and Australian authorities. In 1934, there was a strong bias within the British Empire towards anything made in Britain, and for him to prefer an American plane was deemed unpatriotic. Those in the charge of the race raised many obstacles against his entry. Eventually, Smithy withdrew his nomination, which caused further public accusations of cowardice. To show his detractors how wrong they were, he flew his Altair, which he'd named the Lady Southern Cross, across the Pacific from Sydney to California. It was a remarkable journey. He and his co-pilot, Bill Taylor, managed to lob 30 hours off the time Smithy and Ulm had taken to fly the same route in reverse 6 years previously. Now, this should have astonished everyone, and in America it did, and in fact it made Pan Am think that there would probably be a regular service, not all that distant future, between Australia and America. But in Australia, this was considered a sort of aberration on Smithy's part. That people wouldn't congratulate him for it, wouldn't approve of it, and that hurt him deeply. It was related to these rumours that he was a coward and that he was a drunkard, and he was a very sensitive person underneath Smithy, and all that worried him very much. Smithy had scarcely returned from America when he sat out on another epic flight, this time in his beloved Southern Cross. The occasion was a jubilee of King George V. As part of the Empire's celebration, Smithy undertook an MAL flight from Australia to New Zealand. He and his companions, Bill Taylor and John Stanage, set out across the Tasman Sea with 28,000 letters, each letter bearing a special jubilee stamp. The letters, of course, were written by Australians, and they were written to friends and relatives in New Zealand. Smithy and his companions were about 7 hours into the flight when a piece from the central engine's exhaust pipe broke loose and sliced off part of the starboard propeller's wooden blade. The ensuing vibrations were so destabilizing that Smithy shut down the starboard engine and began to battle his way back against a headwind to Sydney. 5 hours later, and still many hours from land, the port engine began to fail for lack of oil. Smithy and his companions recognised that the end was near, for it was only a matter of time before all the engines failed, and in this remote stretch of sea there was no hope of rescue. They began preparations to ditch the plane with heroic calmness, until Taylor suddenly refused to accept defeat and called to Standish to help him. Tying a rope round his waist and attaching the other end to the plane, Taylor climbed out along the strut towards the starboard engine. Of course, they're up in the air. They're up in the air about 500 feet up. Once there, he sat astride the strut and opened the engine's cowling, then removed the drain plug and poured oil from the motor into a thermos flask, which Standish handed to him out the cockpit window. When the flask was full, Taylor returned the flask to Standish, who emptied the oil into a briefcase. Together, they performed this action four more times until the briefcase could hold no more. That done, Taylor inched back into the cockpit and prepared to climb out the window on the other side so as to deliver the oil to the gasping port motor, but this proved virtually impossible. So great was the force of the port propeller's slipstream that Taylor could not even mount the strut. The only solution was for Smithy to shut down the port propeller. Having coaxed the plane to 700 feet, Smithy obediently cut the motor. And while the plane dropped to within 20 feet of the sea, Taylor empties his precious oil into the port engine. At first attempt, he managed to empty only a portion of the contents of the briefcase. It took him several more climbs and drops before he could transfer the full amount, and they were able to watch the pressure rise in the oil gauge. For the time being, they were saved, but this oil lasted less than an hour. Taylor was obliged to make his perilous journey five more times before they reached Sydney. In other words, six times he did this thing across the strut, one way and then the other. A huge crowd awaited them at Mascot Aerodrome for the wireless operator, John Standish, had kept the press informed of their adventure, and all over the globe, the returning aviators were hailed as superheroes. As one reporter put it, they had thrilled every corner of the empire. King George V took the unusual step of bestowing the Medal of Order of the British Empire on Taylor. The medal was seldom awarded and only for the most conspicuous bravery, and it is the same medal that we know today as the George Cross. In the golden age of aviation, the bravery and resourcefulness of aviators was legendary and it often saved lives. Even so, few of the great aviators lived to be old. Their lives were just too perilous, and Smithy's death at the age of 38 made him no exception. He died in November 1935, just a few months after his Tasman adventure. He and his mechanic, Tommy Pretheridge, were on a record time flight from England to Australia in his Altair and were last sighted over the Bay of Bengal heading towards Singapore. Why he went down, nobody knows. Some believe that he passed out in the air and that Tommy, sitting in a cockpit behind his boss, they didn't sit side by side in the Altair, one cockpit there and the cockpit behind, was unaware of the danger until it was too late. It's a feasible explanation because Smithy himself had feared that he might lose consciousness during a panic attack. Others believe that his engine failed. Years later, when more was known about problems of fatigue in Pratt and Whitney Wasp supercharged engines, the theory was put forward that the impeller on the Altair had failed and the engine had shut down. Despite many years of searching, neither the plane nor its occupants have been found, even though in 1937 a wheel was washed up on the island in the Andaman Sea. Rigorous explorations of the island and its surrounds have since been made, and as we speak, another group of searchers is planning to set out. I rather hope they find nothing. Better, I feel, for the legendary Smithy to end his days in mystery. However, it must be said that the present searchers may have a better chance of finding him than their predecessors. During the long search for the Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, we have learnt that wreckage can drift vast distances. One day, maybe not too far off, the Andaman Sea may give up its secret. The region where Smithy is thought to have died must be one of the most beautiful seascapes in the world. A few years ago, Geoffrey and I sailed through it. Hundreds of islands of different shapes and sizes rise majestically out of an Asia sea. One likes to think that Smithy and Tommy sleep peacefully in their clearest of blue waters. Well, that's it.
Yes, thank you. So many thanks to Anne Blaney. We've got some copies of The Turbulent Life of Charles Kingsford Smith, King of the Air, and I'm sure the author would be happy to sign them after. And so we come to question and discussion. I have to leave about halfway through, but Anne will take over. So obviously, in the modern parlance, these guys were sort of rock stars.
Yep.
And yet, Smith and some of the others sustain a lot of criticism. So, what was this sort of some form of jealousy? And was anyone defending them? I mean, I know that Smith met Billy Hughes. He probably met Bruce. What was the attitude of our political leaders at the time? Did anyone defend Smith, or did they let it pass?
To some extent, only to some extent. Well, Smithy was not popular with people, public servants and politicians, except for Jack Lang. Jack Lang, very, very fond of Smithy. He said, Smithy is a good Australian, in inverted commas. And he said, at the end of his life, he wrote, one of the best things I ever did in my life, maybe the best, was to stake Smithy across the Pacific. But he, by and large, he didn't get on very well with politicians. He was a maverick. And he was terribly irreverent with authority. He liked to tease and bait on occasions. He liked his own way. He felt he knew a lot more about aviation than any of them when they were making pronouncements, and I'm sure that was true. But they didn't like to be reminded of it. He brought a lot of it on himself. But, of course, he was the darling, in many ways, of the ordinary Australian, and that's what he was aiming for. He was a national hero. He was our Smithy, and tremendously popular in those quarters. But when all this happened with Coffee Royal and Anderson died, there was a terrible furor, and The Guardian, which had been his friend up till then, and Smith's Weekly, and they were much read papers with a lot of influence, they took against him. And it's sort of like they did with Melba. Smith's Weekly also took against Melba. I think it's this tall poppy syndrome. They object to anybody who is internationally fated in Australia. Well, that seems to me to be the case, because so much of it was the same as the sort of carry-on that went on about Melba. Melba at one stage didn't know whether she would ever return to Australia. She was so distressed by this sort of behaviour. So that partly answers it. But there were, of course, people who did in power who did support him. That's perfectly true. Bruce was quite good about him. Billy Hughes, he had a strange relationship with Billy Hughes. Billy Hughes, he claimed, had stopped him. There was an air race at the end of the first 1919, and it was for the first people to fly across from England to Australia. And, of course, Ross and Keith Smith won it, the Smith brothers from Adelaide. Smithy had been going to go on it, and he got into a spot of trouble over doing something, a very silly prank that he carried on with second-hand aircraft that he was using for barnstorming. I won't go into it because it's involved, but he doesn't come out of it very honestly, actually. It was very naughty, very adolescent. And this got to the ears of some people in power, and I think it may have got to Billy Hughes' ear, and he had been promoting Smithy to go on this plane, and then he stopped. Smithy never forgave Billy Hughes for this. Whenever his name came up, he would say, "It's that damn fellow who stopped me going from England to Australia." That was what he always said. And yet at other times, Hughes did things of great help for him. So I think Hughes didn't bear him a grudge, but Smithy seemed to bear one back. That doesn't totally answer your question, well, it gives some indication.
It,
yes.
It does. So. Mm.
These guys, these young men in their flying machines, didn't have a lot of money when they started out. If we thought about getting a plane now, we'd have to be, you know, fairly well fleeced. How did they get their first planes? Were planes a lot cheaper then, or did they literally get sponsorship? Because I know Charles Ulm was the actual... He flew Joe Lyons all around southeastern Australia for the 1934 election campaign, which made a huge difference to the ability of politicians to be able to, the Prime Minister to be able to get between states in a short time. So they obviously made money out of their planes, but how did they get the money in the first place to start up?
Well, they started off with this government guarantee from Jack Lang. Then Bavin was voted in, and the government was very upset because there'd been something called the Dole Air Race, which was going from Oakland's in California to Hawaii. And it was a huge crowd. I can't remember how many, but a very large crowd of entrants, and only two people made it, and a whole lot of people crashed and were killed. It put an absolute pall over all thoughts of this type of aviation, and the Australian government got very upset about it. And Bavin, they had a guarantee until the beginning of 1928 from Lang, and after that it had to be renegotiated, and Bavin refused to renegotiate it. So they were completely out. They had no money at all. They'd borrowed money on the strength of this guarantee to get the Southern Cross and have it refitted. But then they were absolutely high and dry because the people wanted it paid back, mortgages and so on they'd taken out, and they didn't know what they were doing. And they would have been completely washed out had it not been for the fact that someone took pity on them and introduced them. First of all, they introduced him to a man called Andrew Chaffee, who was the head of a big bank in California, and he had grown up on the Murray River. His father had been the man, Chaffee, the engineer, who had brought water to the green oases of the dryness of the up in that area. And so he listened with great sympathy to them, and he said, I know a few millionaires who might help. And so he summoned up this man, Alan Hancock, who was an oil millionaire. He had started his life. His parents owned a ranch where Sunset Boulevard and Rodeo Drive and all those places are now, the most expensive real estate probably in the world. And on this ranch, they discovered 17 oil things. And so they were all pumping away and making this enormous amount of money for Alan Hancock. So he had money to spare, and he was enormously interested in aviation. And once he saw that Smithy and Arm were fairly responsible people, not totally, but fairly, and that they had some idea of safety because they were taking a lot of safety regulations and things to help them on this trip across the Pacific, he said, I'll help you, boys. I like the look of you boys. I'll help you. And so he got them, the two American wireless operator and navigator, who were essential for them. Alm could not have navigated across. Alm, I might say, at that stage didn't even have a pilot's license. He could only keep it going if Smithy had it up in the air and everything was going all right. If Smithy would then take a little nap, and if something started to go wrong, Alm would say, wake up, Smithy, do something. He couldn't take off and he couldn't land. So he wasn't much use, really, in the air. He was a good organiser, but he wasn't much use in the air. And in that condition, they had been going to go across the Pacific with Alm navigating. They'd never have done it without these two Americans. So really, Alan Hancock was the reason. And when they made the trip and they were there and they were safe and finished and home, Hancock gave them the plane, Southern Cross. He gave it to them. And eventually, Smithy bought out Alm's share, and he was the sole owner of what he called the old bus. He loved that plane. He loved it as much as anyone ever loved a dog or a horse. It was a living creature as far as he was concerned.
There's a question. We'll go here and then down the front. Okay.
Thank you for a most enjoyable talk. Could you tell us the story of how Kingsford Smith Airport here in Sydney became to be named?
I don't know. Maybe somebody here does. They're about to have celebrations for it because I had a letter from somebody at Kingsford Smith Airport wanting the name and address of Smithy's son because they want to invite him back for the celebrations. But I know nothing about the history of the airport. Does anyone else know? Well, we'll have to find out. That's an interesting question. Thanks for asking.
Can you tell me, please, the manufacturer and the model of the aircraft, the Southern Cross?
The manufacturer, yeah, I've got it. I've got it in the book. I can't tell you offhand. I'm no expert on aeroplanes, but all those things are in the book. So I think you're going to have to buy the book.
Was it the same aircraft that he used to go across to New Zealand?
he used the Southern Cross right till the end of his life. It was the Southern Cross when they went across the Tasman Sea, and it was a Southern Cross that was getting a bit long in the tooth. That was why they had the problems across the Tasman. That was the Southern Cross. It was the Southern Cross he went across the Pacific. It was the Southern Cross he went around the world. The only two really big flights that he did with the Lady Southern Cross, which was its successor, the Altair, the Lockheed Altair, which was a very fast, very modern plane for the time, was across the Pacific, and the one he when he started off to come back from England to Australia, and he went down. That was also the Altair.
Question over here.
I think I can answer some of that. It was a Fokker.
There was a the Southern Cross was a Fokker. Oh yes, a tri-motor Fokker. And but I can't give you the registration number or anything offhand.
It
belonged to Wilkins. That's right, absolutely.
An aviator.
Yes.
Who had it and was not able to do much with it.
He used it in the Arctic. Yes, he used it for exploration in the Arctic, Wilkins.
He didn't achieve anything.
No, not much. It was actually rebuilt. It was largely rebuilt. First of all, it was rebuilt by Smithy when he had the money from Jack Lang. And then later, Alan Hancock said he didn't think the rebuilding was good enough, and he sent it off and had it super rebuilt. Yeah.
Anyone else?
Yeah.
Thank you. I understand Kingsford Smith ran a flying school out of Mascot Aerodrome. Are there any tales to tell? I heard
yes,
that Nancy Bird Walton...
you know what you said about him? Said to her, it may be apocryphal, don't say it's absolutely true, but it should be true. She said, I was one of his female flying pupils. I don't know whether to be glad or sorry. I was the only one of them that he didn't try to get into bed.
you mentioned Empire, King George V. What impacts, if any, did Kingsford Smith have on Australian attitudes to North America?
Well, he was all for North America, and it wasn't very popular in many quarters. That was one of the problems. In fact, he was considered to be... He was at the end of his life, he and Alan were trying to bring an airmail service from Delhi in India down to Australia. Imperial English company, Imperial Airways, took it to Delhi, and Alm was terribly keen that ANA would get the contract to bring it from Delhi down through Singapore and eventually to Australia. There was a lot of... And he wanted to have American planes. That was all Smithy wanted to have American planes. And the thought was also then to take it across the Tasman. That was why they did that airmail flight, was to show it could be done. The fact Smithy wanted American planes so badly was terribly a great mark against him. It was so bad that there were actually questions asked in the House of Commons about the Tasman Sea part with an American plane. The New Zealanders were so upset, the New Zealand government was so orientated to the Empire that they wouldn't accept it at all. They wouldn't have a part of it. So that it didn't do him any good, this thing about it. But I think... I don't think it had any effect on Australia's attitude, that was still very much part of the Empire, and the Empire should have preference, I think. Smithy, I think, was a lone voice in this.
And can you elaborate any more on how Smithy's flight, or his first, that story you referred to, led to the formation of the Royal Flying Doctor Service? Is there any more to that?
There's a very good description in the local newspapers, Western Australian newspapers, of that flight up on the 9th of February 1921, I think it is, or was it 22? I can't remember. It's in the script. I can look in a minute. There's a very good description of that and how excited they were when he brought the doctor up, because they hailed it as a new era when they would have medical attention in these very remote places. It was quite touching to read this account. And later on, there are mentions in the paper of him taking patients. Because this air service was considered such a unique thing, there's a great deal, reporters write a great deal about it, and you can get a lot of material about that, the sort of things they did. They brought in those Bristol Tourer planes. So if you're interested, it would be worth looking. looking it up. You can get it, of course, on the internet now. It's all been digitalised. All those Western, the West Australian and the other local papers. So I can't tell you any more, much more on that, except that it's certain that he did that flight, and there are other mentions of taking patients and doctors. It's Western Australia. They couldn't start from Perth, the service from Perth, because the train went to Perth and it had a monopoly. So it had to be from Geraldton up, and they went as far as Derby. And I think it was to Derby he took the doctor to the patient. He started from Geraldton, from Perth, but he then had to stop in Geraldton and then started the service up.
To what extent is it recognised in aviation history that Australia really did play a pioneering role? Because if you go through those stories that you've told and you look at what was happening in the Australian continent, it was really a moment when, apart from the First World War and whatever, we really put ourselves on the international stage.
Oh, absolutely.
So can you elaborate on how they contributed to not only our national notions, but also what happened with what their daring exploits did for aviation?
Well, they showed... Well, all those pioneering flights that start about 1930, they're showing that, you know, the world will shrink. Tyranny of distance sort of business, isn't it? Distance is no longer a tyrant. It can be broken down. And in due course, we're going to be able to move goods and people very quickly between country and country. And people will just begin. But the question was how fast they could do it. Because if it took a very long time, why not send them by ship? This is probably easier and more convenient. But all these, Charlie Scott and Jim Mollison and Smithy and all these people who did these time flights, and they were terribly grueling. And most of these people were very young. Smithy's over 30 by this time. These are all young men in their 20s who's mostly doing it, are showing that this is a practical thing for the future and our lives will be different. It's a bit like the internet now and what the internet did, really. There are new improvements to planes almost every month. Someone puts something different in a plane and people get excited about it and they see a new future opening up, quite different to the old past. And that part's very exciting. And Smithy is the greatest of this era. Smithy is undoubtedly the greatest flyer.
Yeah. So on the internet, you didn't have to get out on the wing.
No, we didn't. Although people may get so exasperated, they may do very silly things with it, yes.
And I just, while we're sitting here, I just received a text from a lady called Gillian Kingsford-Smith in Brisbane.
From someone called Gillian Kingsford-Smith in Brisbane.
She's a friend of mine. And she said, I'm listening to you. And she said, oh, wow, I was only thinking about her in her book the other day. I'm just boarding a flight from Melbourne back to Brisbane, always flying, runs in the family.
Smithy was one of seven, and all his brothers and sisters had, well, all but one brother and sister had children, so children.
A descendant of one of the brothers.
So she's one of those sideways descendants, whom there are a great many. Yes, well, that's very exciting. It just shows what the internet can do, doesn't it?
Any further questions? Okay, well, we might close it there, but before I do close it, if anyone would like to have a peep, Susan Hook here has got, what is it, the original script.
Yeah.
For the movie made in what year?
45
by
Ken Hall.
Yeah. And if you'd like to have a peep at it, we've got an artefact.
Very nice. Very. Anyway, thank you for bringing it. Great fun to have it. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Anne, and I'll say thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.